You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Wednesday, September 27th, 2017. My name is Michael Brooks. I am Michael Wednesday. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Sean Illing of Vox joins us to discuss the deeper implications of Trump's war with the NFL, sports and resistance, and what the alt-right gets wrong about philosophy, Nietzsche specifically. Graham and Cassidy say that their bill is dead, but as we keep saying, it's only a temporary reprieve. As long as Republicans are in power, they are going to destroy all of the gains of Obamacare, no matter how modest, to fund tax breaks for the rich. Donald Trump has used a crisis in Puerto Rico to say that they should pay off their debts to banks in that colonized, austerity-ravaged island. And he also has some interesting insights on Puerto Rico's geography. Roy Moore defeated Luther Strange as the Republican nominee for Senate in Alabama. Touch on that. What did Donald Trump do in response to his preferred candidate losing? Stanley Greenberg's assessment of the core areas that the Clinton campaign missed, some specific to her, some reflecting a broader problem in the Democratic coalition. We'll reflect on that. And new ABC polls. Shockingly show overwhelming opposition to tax giveaways to rich people, the heart of the Republican agenda. Sean Hannity looking very displeased with life on some satellite footage. Play that for you. And Jim Baker. Those food buckets apparently are not selling fast enough, so they've got to uptick the marketing strategy, shifting from a staying alive sales tactic to a going to hell sales tactic.
Sort of paternalistic feed that if you're rich, just buy a bunch of these buckets and feed people.
Buy a bunch of these buckets and feed people. It's pretty simple. All the money's going to go anyways, which wonder why Jim Baker needs it so much then. All that and more on today's Majority Report. Joined as always by super producer Matt Luck. We're going to get to Sean Illing in the moment, but this was Lindsey Graham and Bill Cassidy yesterday announcing that for now their attack on Medicaid and people with pre-existing conditions is in temporary retreat.
Been up here 20 years. I've never enjoyed anything more. I believe this is the most important thing I can ever do for the country, working with my colleagues, is not to just repeal Obamacare, but to replace it with a system closer to where you live, controlled by people you can vote for. And we're going to get there. To my Republican colleagues, we're going to fulfill our promise to repeal and replace. To the American people, we're going to improve health care for you, because at the end of the day, that's the only promise that matters.
Well, to be clear, through events that are under our control and not under our control, we don't have the votes. Okay? That's in speaking to the leadership, speaking to the president. I think Lindsey and he are on speed dial. We've made the decision, since we don't have the votes, we will postpone that vote. Okay?
Okay, so there you have it. They're obviously still gunning for it. And these different hustles and side deals Haven't worked yet. There was even question about the constitutionality of essentially offering Lisa Murkowski a Obamacare Plus for Alaska specifically. Susan Collins is still a firm no in spite of the bribes that they tried to give Maine. And John McCain, you know, frankly, just would have looked ridiculous if he went back on his vote against it on procedural grounds. There's no doubt they're getting calls from their top donors about this. Major tantrums from the plutocrats that run the Republican Party and want to take your health care away to give more money to themselves. This is alive. It also needs to be destroyed to fund generation-defining entrenchment of inequality in terms of Republican massive tax giveaways. So I would say keep calling and stay on and just be relentless, relentless, relentless. Energy, 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 because these people are going to keep trying, whether it's, you know, an extreme fanatical ideology, doing favors for their donors, whatever it is, they're still gunning for the well-being of the country and to take away tens of millions of people's health coverage and to put people with pre-existing conditions back on the margins of even private health insurance. That's the goal. They're not going to stop. Last night, I had a great Michael Brooks show. More people reaching out who are just checking in. We did a kind of deep dive on Germany, India, the global far right with Corey Pine. Then Matt Chrisman came in. We had an extended takedown of Steven Crowder. I did an analysis of Bernie Sanders' foreign policy in the commentary. And Nation of Islam, Obama called Mark Zuckerberg. And then there was an internal monologue from Maoist Bernie. This weekend on the Illicit History, Adam Proctor and I are talking about a coup d'etat that happened in Williamson, North Carolina in 1898 and how that re-entrenched Jim Crow and disrupted an incredibly important sort of progress in actual multiracial governance during Reconstruction and tied it to some of the conflicts of capital and race that we see today. If you haven't checked it out yet, check it out on Michael Brooks' playlist, Michael Brooks Show playlist on the Sam Cedar channel, or subscribe to Michael Brooks Show on iTunes. And of course, we're at 665 patrons. Become a patron, get the whole thing, get a ton extra as a patron. Patreon.com/TMBS. Thank you everybody else who's been becoming a patron, subscribing, sharing it. We're getting a lot of energy and a lot of good feedback. I appreciate it immensely. And I appreciate Matt for helping me make it happen. And, you know, that's how we're able to do it and pay all the bills. Thanks a million. We'll be right back with Sean Ealing on the Majority Report. Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Sean Ealing from Vox. Sean, how you doing?
I'm doing well, buddy. It's good to be back.
It's great to be talking with you. This is long delayed and finally happening. It's great to have you on the show, man.
Yeah, it's you're right, man. It has been a while, so it's good to chat, man.
As always. Sean, what your take? You're someone, you're writing at Vox. I always appreciate looking at because you definitely, you have space to take a wider view, whether it's philosophical, political, historical, legal, economic. One of the things that, I mean, I think as a first order, it's vital that the origins of the NFL protests and this whole controversy not get lost, which is Colin Kaepernick at obvious, incredible personal risk was taking a knee to address systemic racism, murder, police abuse of people of color. That's the issue. It's not a sort of dispute about Trump being a jerk. I want that not to be lost. But I also think there's even a deeper history here of sports and resistance and race. And, you know, when Trump says, get a son of a bitch back out on the field, it's not just, you know, his, you know, being his sort of usual horrible melted brain self. He's tapping into, as he usually does with race, into a very ugly history there.
Right. And this is part of what's so frustrating about this, right, is it's clear what Trump is doing. This is his shtick,
right?
He picks an issue like this, which is really a non-issue issue, that will charge up his cultural base, but which has really nothing to do or makes no material impact on the people who voted for him and on their lives, right? It's pure red meat. And we in the media are forced to sort of chase it like a greyhound because he just, you know, drops the turd on the table and now we have to address it.
Right.
But, I mean, so there's that, right? And then there's just sort of the fraudulence of the outrage on the other side, right? All these people caping up for the American flag and for the national anthem. You'd think all these millions of people exercised about this would be overseas fighting to defend that sacred symbol that they so adore. And yet they're so charged up about this. And, you know, look, I say this as a veteran. You take an oath to defend the Constitution, not the damn flag or the anthem.
Right.
And free men and women protesting is an affirmation of the Constitution. And so anyone who objects to that is constitutionally ignorant and really charged up about something else that has nothing to do with these symbols. It's, as always with Trump, about culture and race and all the rest of it.
Yeah, and isn't it really important now? I mean, there's these debates, you know, that are alive. I think, frankly, my editorial, I think a lot of them are pretty misdirected and pretty trivial. You know, I'm very unimpressed by Mark Lilla's book as an example. And then I also think that there is a deployment of a certain type of identity politics, which I have profound disagreement with. But it just seems to me that it's amazing that even with all of the sort of focus on Trump and this way that, and let's be clear too, that there's a, that this is the modern Republican Party. It's definitely not just Trump, but he does it with less subtext. But that this notion of white identity politics isn't just firmly in the vernacular now, because that's really what it is.
No, and there's really no getting around it now. I mean, it's not, I mean, the sorts of issues that Trump takes and the moments he chooses to take a stand are so carefully calibrated to tap in to all these sort of cultural anxieties and racial resentments that at some point it's just impossible to deny that there's a reason and a method to it, that it's not just, he's not just tripping on a banana peel and stumbling into these racial landmines, right? Like he's clearly deciding to poke these or pull these levers that are going to sort of divide the country along these racial fault lines. And he's doing it deliberately and he's doing it because it's really the only play in his playbook, right? What the hell is he going to do? Is he going to talk about healthcare policy or tax cuts or North Korea? I mean, other than tweeting about,
well,
these
he
things,
sure will tweet about North Korea, right? And
yeah,
I think when he does talk about that stuff, I think what's very evident is that all of this stuff, you know, what was odd about Trump was that where he was effective in the Republican primary was that he dropped the pretext and said,
yeah,
did overt misogyny, did overt bigotry, did overt xenophobia. And then at the same time, actually, and he was lying and hustling, but gave a more honest economic appraisal than any modern Republican has done for people that aren't ultra wealthy. And he did that with talking about trade agreements, talking about preserving Social Security and Medicare. Now, so the kind of question was, and you know, for me, I had no doubt. I don't think you had any doubt that the kind of economic hustle would get thrown out quickly. But, you know, how does those two strands get reconciled? And what it has become and what it was, again, even before Trump, is that when he is talking about healthcare, or he is talking about North Korea, or he's talking about global warming or whatever, it might as well be him racializing and throwing red meat about the NFL, because it's all just cultural aggrievement. That's all it is, even if it is policy, quote unquote.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's right. I think those strands don't get reconciled, and I think that's the point, right? I think the fact that those are the two pillars of his campaign, and the fact that as soon as he gets elected, he basically abandons one of them entirely, right? Surrounds himself with Goldman Sachs bankers and wants to slash healthcare for millions of people. But he continues to toe the line on the racial resentment front, right? And his voters haven't left him. His core, his base, they aren't going anywhere. They're still solidly in his camp. So that tells you all you need to know about what matters most to a lot of these people.
That's exactly right. Now, you know, before we get to this alt-right thing, I mean, do you think moving forward, and there are ways in which Trump is obviously, you know, bad seed, singular entity, you know, I mean, just this sort of, he is a uniquely grotesque figure. But at the same time, there's a formula here that he's developed, which I don't think took really particularly deep insight about understanding the modern nature of the Republican Party to tap into. And, you know, you look to the future, and whether you're talking about, you know, a Tom Cotton or, you know, Ted Cruz obviously wants to stay on the national radar. These characters, I mean, how do you see the next phase of Trumpism? Because I just don't think there's any doubt that even if he loses re-election, you know, pray to Allah, that this still is the formula of a modern Republican coalition. This is where the potency is. There's no other figure, Paul Ryan, Mike Pence, nobody who's got the pop that this guy has with the base. Part of it's attitudinal, but it is also that fusion of faking on economics and being overt on bigotry.
Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree with any of that. I don't think anyone really knows what comes next, but I think it's pretty clear to me that Trumpism doesn't need Trump. Right. That, I mean, all this stuff has been festering in the body politic for a very long time. And as you said, he just cut the bullshit. Right. He just came clean and was completely naked about what he was doing, dropped the subtext. And it clearly worked. Right. And so now that cat's out of the bag. And I don't know how you put it back in. Right. Even if Trump goes away in 3 years or 4 years or whatever. Right. Like, he has laid down a blueprint for how to exercise these parts of the base. And so why wouldn't somebody follow in his footsteps and do the same thing?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You are a trained philosopher.
Whatever that means, right?
Well, I guess Marco Rubio would have beef with that. I remember when he had some doing his, like, the idea of people reading Plato or whatever made his mouth get really dry. But like everything else, but you have this piece, where you kind of dipped your toe into the more sort of deeply pretentious recesses of the kind of hard alt-right. And if we're going to, you know, make a somewhat of a distinction between the kind of, like, you know, the Mike Cernovich, Alex Jones kind of freak show Twitter, YouTube universe alt-right, which obviously is, you know, fueled by the same kind of conspiracy theories and racial demagoguery and sexism and everything else, but is, you know, is fundamentally kind of social media entertainment product kind of scams and hustles and that sort of thing. You know, but then there are these other sort of grotesque strand of a, you know, Richard Spencer or a Giorgiani, these people that fancy themselves as very deep thinkers. And like a lot of other unpleasant young men who fancy themselves deep thinkers, they've found a German philosopher that has a notorious name and have chosen to misread him. And I leave that, you know, take it from there.
Well, look, you know, racist assholes are annoying enough, but when racist assholes invoke all these fancy philosophical authorities in order to justify their racism, well, that's even more annoying.
Right.
And that is what has happened with Nietzsche, right? That's a name everyone knows, but not that many people have actually read him. And a lot of the people that have read him very superficially. And so I wrote that piece, you know, in college, I wrote a dissertation about Nietzsche, which probably has no practical utility in the world. But this was one moment where it actually seemed useful to opine, right? And I saw this great Atlantic piece a while back that Graham Wood did, where it was kind of a profile, Richard Spencer, right? And he had said that he was, you know, red-pilled by Nietzsche, right? Red-pilled is the stupid phrase they use to describe their big aha, eureka moment when they finally see the world as it really is.
Right.
And so he's this, you know, philosophical grandfather of their movement. And much like the Nazis, I think also falsely invoked Nietzsche. But the problem is that it doesn't make any sense, right? And so, you know, the alt-right, before it became sort of explicitly white supremacist, it was this sort of fringe online discursive movement that was about, you know, kind of poking holes in taboos and being transgressive and ironical and all that silly shit.
Right, exactly.
If you read Nietzsche, right, he says all this stuff about how conventions and taboos and values are basically contingent and bullshit, and these are constructs, and you don't have to believe them. You can transcend them, and blah blah blah. And so they find all that exciting, right? But the next move that Nietzsche makes is to tell people to throw out all that stuff. Don't retreat into group identity. Don't retreat into religion. Don't retreat into the herd, as he calls it, and just replace your identity with some other one. And that's what these people do, right? They have this weird fascination with Christendom, but they're atheists. They're not Christians, but they're attached to Christendom because they think that's sort of the glue that holds together like white European identity. And so they want to defend Christendom, but they don't identify as religious in any way, right? Which is completely antithetical to Nietzsche's philosophy. And so I just took an opportunity to sort of call out their bullshit and the contradictions at the core of their kind of pseudo half-baked philosophy. And of course, you never miss an opportunity to poke at Richard Spencer, who's just sort of the, you know, king douchebag of that movement.
Right, right. And so basically what Nietzsche was saying was that there was this these classical, and he did idealize these kind of like romantic, or he would say classical Greek kind of values of individuality, vitality, you know, breaking conventions, individual sense of accomplishment, and then that Christendom, and ironically, in Nietzsche's formulation, Christianity came in as this like force of mediocrity and broke culture down to the lowest common denominator. But I guess he didn't just say don't replace one group identity with another. He also, his conception even of that kind of classic individualist framework for Nietzsche was not like the equivalent of some like dumb Ayn Rand fantasy about building a building. It really maybe had more to do with, you know, I don't know, somebody doing something sort of like radically unconventional. It might even be like somebody deciding to, like, you know, I don't know, go to the Himalayas or something and become a yogi or something. Like, actually something like that might be more in line with that Nietzschean impulse than either, you know, win a capitalist game or certainly trade in one silly Twitter identity for another.
Right. I mean, Nietzsche's biggest fear was that in the 20th century, as people stopped believing in God, that they would sort of retreat into ethno-identity or you know, political ideology, like basically just replace a theological religion with a political religion or with a racial religion. And that was just replacing one type of era with another. Right. And so the whole point of his philosophy was to enjoin people to go their own way, to be individuals, to make their own values, right, and to not just disappear into another kind of ideology. And that's exactly what the alt-right has done, become a kind of ethno-religion, which is explicitly what Nietzsche condemned. And so, I mean, it's absurd. They're not serious readers of Nietzsche or anyone for that matter. They're just looking for excuses for their bullshit racism when it's just racism. It's not Nietzsche. It's not philosophy. It's just racism.
Right. Absolutely. So why, really briefly, why is Nietzsche susceptible to these idiots? What is it about Nietzsche that draws the worst, even when he's not exactly articulating that himself?
Well, you ask Nietzsche scholars, if you'll get a different answer. I mean, my answer is in part because of the way he wrote. Right? He wrote in contradictions. He wrote in puzzles. Part of his whole point was that nothing is really capital T true, and so you shouldn't wed yourself to some viewpoint or some ideology and then spend the rest of your life defending it. And so he took all kinds of positions. He contradicts himself from one book to another, and his whole point was that you should experiment, try to see the world from different points of view, but never take it too seriously, because on a long enough timeline, it's all bullshit anyway. So he does write in a way where almost everyone can, if you just dip into Nietzsche for a page or two, you could pluck something and find a justification for almost anything. But if you read him in his totality, you see his broader point, which is that none of it is really true, and you shouldn't take any of it that seriously.
Final question. I know you have to run, but I mean, has there been, you not only sort of schooled them on Nietzsche and sort of, I think in some ways, especially for some of these characters like Spencer, there could be nothing more upsetting for them. You know, when we kind of morally respond to them for their grotesque positions and the genocidal implications and practice of what they advocate, they love that because that plays into their self-concept. But when they're mocked and ridiculed and stripped naked in terms of their just basic intellectual mediocrity, I would imagine that that makes them deeply uncomfortable, because this is the whole, you know, ego game they're playing. So has there been a response, or have they just tried to ignore you, or what?
I was actually surprised. It's been mostly radio silence. You always get the initial wave of asinine emails, that kind of thing.
Right.
But I never heard a peep from Spencer. I never heard a peep from any of the sort of, major, pseudo thinkers on the alt-right. No one really responded to the piece in print, as far as I know of. Maybe someone did in some, far-fledged corner of the interwest. I don't know. But for the most part, I haven't heard much of anything. So I take that as a minor victory, my friend.
Well, I love it. It's a great piece. Everybody should read it. And all of Sean Ealing's work. Sean Ealing, you can find him over at Vox. I appreciate your time so much, man. Thanks so much.
Anytime, buddy. Talk soon.
Absolutely. Take care. All right, folks, that was obviously a touch short. So we're going to go to the fun half in just a moment. But let's just...
It's like a nice little In Our Time segment on Nietzsche there.
Yeah, that's what I was kind of hoping we would do. I mean, there's a lot to take advantage of with Sean, because, not many people have such a kind of broad base to draw on and sort of day in, day out political analysis. So if it's an opportunity to give a nice little tutorial on Nietzsche, I think that's useful for everybody. Let's just play this, and then we'll do the kind of closing spiel. There is a crisis. I mean, Puerto Rico is devastated right now. And still many people without electricity, places to stay. Donald Trump took to Twitter the other day and talked about Puerto Rico paying off its debts, which it's so morally wrongheaded in the longer sweep of American history and colonial occupation in Puerto Rico and state-imposed austerity and economic disadvantage imposed on the island and the quasi-status of not being independent, obviously not being a full state, taxed without representation, serving in the armed forces but not being able to determine who's president. It's grotesque. And as with Trump, there is the grotesque and then there is just the, very dumb. Here he was with the dumb angle on Puerto Rico.
Texas and Florida, and we will also on Puerto Rico, but the difference is this is an island sitting in the middle of an ocean, and it's a big ocean. It's a very big ocean, and we're doing a really good job. I want to...
It's There you have it.
He understands the gravity of the moment.
He clearly understands the gravity of the moment. All right, everybody, we're going to go to the fun half. Become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. That's how it's all possible. New people, you know, new things are happening soon. Really, really excited about this show that we do for you every day. And you are the ones that make it possible. So majority.fm/become a member. Majority Report kickback page. Use our pass-through links. You're going to do shopping on those particular websites. And write us an iTunes review. Of course, if you want to find more from me, Patreon/TMBS. Michael Brooks Show on iTunes. Michael Brooks Show playlist on YouTube. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. The IMs are on. We'll see you in the fun half. Sad.